What's up, my friend? Welcome to the Finding Direction podcast. My name is Stu Massengill, and I'm here every single week to bring you a passionate guest or message dedicated to helping you find your purpose so that you can live a life full of passion, fulfillment, and happiness. From the bottom of my heart, thank you for hanging out with me, and let's dive in. What's up, my friend? Welcome back to another episode here on Finding Direction. I am so excited for you to dive into this week's episode. I am sitting down with a true legend this week. His name is Seth Godin. And if you have not heard of Seth Godin, you can Google him. You will instantly recognize his sort of infamous glasses that he wears. But a little bit about Seth Godin. He is a teacher and an author who over the last 30 years has been trying to turn on the lights, inspire people, and teach them how to level up in their life. He's authored now over 20 best-selling books. They've translated into over 40 different languages. Some of them include the book The Practice, Purple Cow, This is Marketing. He is also in the Marketing Hall of Fame. He's also in the Guerrilla Marketing Hall of Fame. He's in the Direct Marketing Hall of Fame. Clearly, as you can see from that, this man, again, is a legend in his own right. And a few things we dive into on this episode is we dive into how life is like you're either playing golf or you're playing surfing or you're going surfing. We talk about Seth's philosophy on what he chooses to do with his life as he's continued to over and over and over knock the ball out of the park in so many different endeavors. We talk about why you need to stop being a wandering generality. Difficult word to say, and a lot of other things that we dive into in this episode. There is so much goodness. Seth, again, is just got so much wisdom inside of him. So I'm really excited for you to dive into this week's episode. If you have not yet, make sure you hit that subscribe button so you can join us every single week on the show as we bring you new content, insights, and conversations. And without further ado, here we go. Seth Godin, welcome to the show. I am, as we spoke about earlier, honored, grateful, and truly just excited to dive into our conversation. So thank you so much for being here.
What a treat, Stu. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for showing up on the regular. And to the people who listen week after week or day after day, keep going. It matters.
I love it. So as we dive into our conversation today, you know, one of the things I mentioned earlier is you, and I know this conversation is not going to be totally about you, but you have lived a beautiful life. And I think it's always an interesting conversation to look at what makes someone who they are, right? So what makes Seth Godin, Seth Godin, and the journey that you've been through? And how can our listeners maybe model some of the things that you've done to live just a beautiful life, I guess we could call it. And so I would be curious if we, you know, look through your journey. You've had zigs, zags, you've done numerous things, and not just done them, but you've done them extraordinarily well. You've become a master at your art, really. And I'm curious, to just start off, what would be your philosophy that you've had as you've continued to zig and zag throughout your life? Like, is there a philosophy you come to when you go, you know what, I just wrote this book and it's another bestseller. Now I got to zag and I got to go do this other thing, whether it could be some of the programs you've launched, it could be something else. But what's the philosophy that goes through Seth's brain when you go from a zig to a zag?
It's a great question. And I just wrote a whole book about it because we have been indoctrinated from an early age to ask, will this be on the test to get an A, to do what the teacher says, to go to the placement office, to get picked, to have a resume, to get a job, to stick with the job, to please the boss, to get paid so we can buy more crap, so we can put it in a storage unit and die. And there's a good reason we built that system. It made more people more money than anything in the history of humans. Right. The problem with that system and the problem with human resources is that humans aren't a resource. Your function is not to be present to make more money for your boss. Humans aren't a resource. Humans are the point. And so what I have been trying to do, and I've been a professional now for 41 years, is do work that I'm proud of, that's interesting, that solves an interesting problem that benefits other people. And if I can make money doing that, that's great, but that's not the point. Yeah. The point is to explore the edges. And if you think about the difference between surfing and golf, it's pretty clear how to deal with this. Golf is asymptotic toward perfection, that what you're trying to do is just shave off one stroke here or there. And if they move the holes on the golf course, there's a lot of meetings about how to do that because it matters a great deal to the inch. Surfing, on the other hand, the waves are different every single day. And you can't win in a day of surfing. All you can do is surf. And my goal is to get one more wave. My goal is to surf. I have no interest in playing golf.
Interesting. So it's a much more creative process than a perfection. Like there's a quote that pops in my mind. It says, imperfect action is 10 times better than perfect action. And it sounds like in the life that you've lived, it's more so been, how do I take some imperfect action that creates a piece of art that I can share to help other people that's interesting, that solves an interesting problem, rather than how do I do it perfectly?
I'm in favor of perfect if I'm going in for surgery. And my guess is that imperfect action is 10 times better than a perfect meeting. Because perfect action is great. Sign me up for that. But I have no interest in perfect meetings. So the goal, you know, if you're looking for your keys, don't keep looking in the same place over and over again. The looking for the keys is the point of it. We're alive. We're trying to find a new way, a better way, an interesting way, a generous way. And we do that by looking in lots of places.
Gotcha. Very cool. So one thing, you know, as I did some of my research on you that has come up, I think it's maybe your favorite quote. I could be wrong on this, but it's something Zig Ziglar said. And he said that the worst thing is to be a wondering generality. You need to be a meaningful specific. Maybe isn't your favorite quote, but I think it's something that resonates with your life. And I would be curious, how do you think someone goes about finding a meaningful specific? I think that's one of the searches that many people are on, is what is the meaningful specific?
All right, so let's decode the quote for people who aren't like me. Yeah. Zig Ziglar, acolytes. He was a friend and a teacher before he passed.
Yeah.
To be a meaningful specific means that you are on the hook, that you're not for everybody, and that you are making a specific promise and keeping it. To be a wandering generality is to say, if you're looking for anybody, I'm anybody. To be a wandering generality is to be off the hook. And part of the conceit of this podcast is there are people who are looking for their calling. And what the wizard said to Dorothy is, you've had the slippers on all along. Your calling isn't something that finds you. You already have it. But what you're doing is hiding. You are hiding from the specificity, from the being on the hook, from the promise that you are capable of making. And it's super safe to hide. Say, oh, I don't feel authentic. I'm just waiting for my calling to arrive, to find my passion, which is complete and utter nonsense. That Van Gogh, if he was alive today, his passion would not be oil painting. And if Steve Jobs had lived 200 years ago, his passion would not be personal computers. Passion isn't a career. Passion is a choice. And the minute you want to get passionate about something and be fully on the hook as a human, you can do it right now.
Why do you think people have a sense of fear of picking the specific thing that they want to do? Because it's a beautiful insight, right? That it's, well, if I don't know what I need to do, then maybe I can't fail. I can't, you know, be wrong. So why do you think people put themselves through it?
In second grade, you showed your teacher some finger painting you made and she made a face, just a tiny face, but she made a face and you felt terrible. If you hadn't done the finger painting, you wouldn't have felt terrible. That every chance we have to sort of bob and weave, it sort of works out because we can stay in the middle of our lane and we don't have to worry about giving a talk, being judged, getting feedback. Oh, no, that's not what I meant, right? To be on the hook is to say, hi, I'm a surgeon. You have a clogged artery. I'm going to cut you open and save your life. And if I fail, you're going to die. That is a meaningful specific. That is something I don't have the stomach to do, but some people do.
Right.
And that's because they care enough to save someone's life and are willing to risk killing them to do so. And, you know, if you're 30 years old, that's a scary thing to hear unless you've been to medical school. But you only got 100 years left. What are you going to do with it? You can whine about the climate, or you can be on the hook to do something about the climate. And we can go down the long list of things that need your attention. But don't just show up with a notebook and take notes. That worked in fifth grade. It's not what we need adults to do.
Yeah. How have you in your own life pulled out? Because, you know, obviously you've given a very famous TED talk that was all about the school system and how it kind of, there's some benefits, but it also hurts us in some ways. And it seems like you've been able to take the part of your brain out that's that second grade teacher looking at you going, whoa, Seth, what's up with your painting? You've been able to remove that and say, I'm going to press send. I'm going to publish. I'm going to do the practice, do the work, and I'm going to put this into the world. So how have you yourself been able to take that part of your brain out and say, it could be wrong. Someone could look at me funny. It may not be the right thing that I'm supposed to do, but I'm still going to press send. I'm still going to move forward.
So, in a couple of weeks or whenever, I don't even know what month it is. Every year in March or April, they run a marathon in Boston. And the Boston Marathon is interesting because a lot of people run in it. Many of them finish and many of them quit at mile 20. And the thing is that some people think that the people who quit at mile 20 are tired and the people who make it to the end have trained better. This is not true. In fact, every single person who finishes the marathon is tired. And the people who've quit at mile 20, also tired, but they couldn't figure out where to put the tired. So you can't go to a trainer or listen to a podcast or read a book that will tell you how to run the marathon without getting tired. Can't be done. I didn't remove the part of my brain that Miss Binder is in. I'm really aware of it. And I know exactly what Millie Blaisdell wrote in my high school yearbook, which is, you are the bane of my existence and you will never amount to anything. I know it word for word. So it's still there. And hitting send, doing a podcast, it still brings up the same feelings. The difference is I figured out where to put the fear. I figured out where to put the tired. And that is the practice. The practice is not to get rid of imposter syndrome, not to get rid of writer's block. The practice is to acknowledge that it exists and do it anyway.
Interesting. So it's almost putting the fear on the other side of pressing send.
No, it's embracing the fear. Because if I don't feel afraid, then I'm not trying hard enough.
That's beautiful. I love that. So another thing, you know, that you talk about quite often is this idea, and I love, you know, numerous keynotes you've given, there's a theme sometimes that pops up that when you have seen something, you can't unsee something. And it's like this switch that goes off in the brain when all of a sudden you go, it's like your way of thinking shifts, your paradigm shifts. All of a sudden, I mean, everything in the world can look differently because you see the world differently. And, you know, for our listener who is trying to figure out this game of life, right, with the goal to live happy, fulfilled, and just a life that they can be proud of, what do you think are some of the common things and common ways people see the world that they need to shift that can maybe help them be able to not unsee the world in this way anymore?
Right. So I've got 9,000 blog posts worth of things you can't unsee, but I'll try to pick some of the highlights. The first one we've already talked about is that you have been brainwashed and indoctrinated by the people who built public school, which is built on the Prussian paramilitary system of the 1800s, invented by factory owners to train children to be willing to work in a factory, which is unnatural. You might discover that plastic is not recyclable and that the term carbon footprint was invented by British Petroleum to trick us into thinking that if we're a hypocrite, we have no business talking about the climate, that once you see just how much we have been pushed to discard stuff, to build wealth on burning things, it's very hard to unsee that. You might discover that the people who would like you to think that there is a correlation between how much money someone has and how smart they are or how hard they work, those things aren't completely incorrect. Some of the dumbest people I have ever met are billionaires. They just happen to be really good at a little certain game, but they're not wise or brilliant. They're just good at a certain game. And I guess the biggest one is that things are far more malleable and changeable than you might think. That the world we live in today would be unrecognizable 25 years ago, just 25 years. That, for example, the amount of information that is produced every single day in the world is now more than the amount of information that was invented, created in the entire world before 1960. We make more in one day than the whole world made in the history of the world until 1960, right? So we look around and we say, oh, well, Twitter's going to last forever. No, it's not. Twitter's going to go bankrupt. And it matters that I have a lot of followers on Facebook. No, it doesn't. And they're not your friends. I mean, there's all of these things we take for granted and think are important when we're actually just getting gamed.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. So I'm curious, if you could go to, let's say, a college campus, or you could give a commencement speech, right? As people are transitioning into this phase of their world, of the real world, and sort of figuring out their life, what do you think your commencement speech would be about?
So I've been asked to give them. This is a speech that, that you're giving to people who don't want to hear it and they've never heard of you. So that's a bad combination,
particularly not a good audience.
If you're doing it for free. So I don't do commencement speeches, but my commencement speech would be really short, which is, what the hell are you doing looking for advice in a commencement speech? Because you already know what to do. You don't need more time. You just need to decide. That ship the work, not because it's due, but because you can. Make things better, not because you're going to get paid, but because you can. That if you figure out how to be missed if you are gone, then people will ask you to come back. And once that happens, you get to decide what your life is like. Freedom as a human being is very powerful, but you don't get freedom unless you can create possibility for others.
Interesting. So it's almost like everybody's waiting for someone to give them a piece of advice to so they can know what to do, when the reality is just kind of a cop-out that you already know what you need to do. But again, it comes back to this conversation of maybe there's the fear and where you're placing it. But really, you know what you need to do.
So here's an exercise that I think is worth considering. I want you to imagine that we invite 20 of the people that you work with today or that you hung out with the most your last job or in college. There's 20 of you around a table. And I walk in, I say, good news. I was talking to Bill Gates yesterday, and he's just allocated $4 million for this two-week sprint, a two-week research project. I'm going to give $1 million to you, the person who's organizing it, and you get to invite three of the people at this table to be on your team to do this work together. And each one of them gets $250,000. So it's a good gig. Yeah. So what I want you to do is write down on this index card of this group of people, who are the three people you want on your team? So then I would ask the group the following questions. Question number one, how many of you think that the same person's name came up again and again? And generally in a group of people who have known each other for more than a couple of weeks, people agree, yeah, there are a few people whose names came up again and again.
Yeah.
Second question, how many of you think your name came up more than a couple of times? And that makes people really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And the third question is, if you decided in the next cohort you were a part of that you wanted your name to come up more than it did, would you act differently? Because if you become the kind of person that other people want on that short list, a whole bunch of things get better in your life. And by the way, you'll have discovered your purpose.
Mm. Can you expand upon that a little bit? How do you mean that helps you discover your purpose?
Because your purpose is to be of use, to do work you're proud of with people you care about. Your purpose is to show up somewhere and be missed if you were gone. Your purpose is to say, I'm not just a veterinarian. I'm the kind of veterinarian that if I moved to another town, my patients would insist that their owners take them there instead, right? That fuels you. You're not just doing your job so then you can go home and have a couple of beers and watch Netflix. You're doing your job because you understand that you are contributing in a way that people care about. That's the whole game.
And if you, let's say you've realized that I'm not contributing in the way that I want, how does someone start to shift to contribute to something that's meaningful to them?
Right. Well, here's what does not work. Blaming your boss. Because if no one who works for your boss feels good, then you should leave. And if some people who work for your boss are finding their footing, then what are they doing that you're not? We live in a universe where we have, even though there's so much social injustice and caste, and there are countries where there isn't a lot of independent freedom, the people who are listening to this have the freedom to listen to it. The people who are listening to this have the freedom to publish online. The people who are listening to this have the freedom to switch jobs. So you have the ability to put yourself on the hook, and surely you're good at something. And if you're not good at something, you know how to learn how to get good at something. The access to information is not the hard part. So what you're doing is, my friend Steve Pressfield calls this resistance. The resistance is all the excuses we make up to get off the hook. And what I'm encouraging you to do, even though you're not a fish, is to get on the hook, because being on the hook is the best place to be.
Yeah. It's a beautiful sort of simplistic way that you break down like living a meaningful life, right? Like when I have the conversation with you, it's like, well, duh, it's pretty simple. Do something that, you know, is meaningful to you, add value to others, and do it in a way where if you were gone, people would miss you. It feels like it brings a lightness to this idea of purpose. I think in today's world, and I would be curious to hear your thoughts on this too, it seems like people have almost brought this like weight and this heaviness to purpose. That's almost like the norm today versus the outlook you have on it is it doesn't need to be so heavy.
Yeah, I mean, here's why the smartphone has made us even more disappointed, bitter, and depressed than we used to be. Because every person who's listening to this grew up in the age of industrialism. Industrialism started in 1908, and the combination of machines, the assembly line, and fossil fuels made a lot of people rich. But it turned humans into resources, but humans aren't a resource, humans are the point. And yet, there are people who are talking about purpose and higher whatever, and a whole bunch of folks who are busy watching it on TikTok say, yeah, I don't have that. Right? And so we are vicariously listening to the narrative of people who have found purpose, and it makes us feel worse, not better, because it feels like we're getting ripped off. But there is a barista at the gluten-free bakery down the street, and when you walk in and she looks you in the eye and she smiles at you, you're glad she's on the shift today. Yeah. And she goes home at the end of the day and she says, I'm working my way toward a job that pays me more. But I dealt with 40 people today who treated me well and I liked them. Hmm. Well, what's wrong with that? That's human. Not to be a cog in the system, but to be a human. And humanity lights us up. You know, 10,000 years ago, cavemen, Marshall Salins wrote the definitive book on this in 1963. Cavemen were really happy. They were fairly healthy, though they died in their 30s. And they only work 2 hours a day. So what kind of progress have we made? That if you can't live a life better than a caveman, why are you taking up space?
Yeah. I love it. So if we go to another piece of your work, one of the things you talk a lot about is the idea of streaks. And I would be curious, I don't know the exact number, but I know with your blog, you've done probably the world's longest streak posting a blog, let alone doing anything consecutively days in a row. And I'm curious, what do you think is the power of streaks, really?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm sure people have done something more days in a row than me, like breathing, but yeah, I've written my blog every single day for more than 20 years, more than 9,000 posts. And the reason is because 20 years ago, I said that in 2023, on Tuesday, May 30th, I'm going to have a blog post at 5 a.m. I decided that 20 years ago. So I don't have to spend any time deciding whether I have something that's good enough to post. All I have to do is say, what's the best available post I've got? Because it's tomorrow. So that means every night I go to sleep saying, I need to think of something useful to say to people. And so I don't go to bed thinking about The Mandalorian. I go to bed thinking about my readers. And this streak of knowing I don't have to reconsider the path. I would write my blog even if no one read it. Because what a gift to know that I am keeping this public record of the things that I've noticed, the things I can't unsee. It makes me better. And one of the byproducts is it helps my readers.
I love it. What's a streak you would consider someone to start in their life? Like, let's say someone is, again, going towards the goal of a meaningful life. What's a good streak, or two or three, or one of any, that somebody could start that would enrich their life?
Here's a really simple streak, and everyone is capable of it. Get a stack of index cards, and every single day, send someone who you cannot get anything in return from a thank you note. You can hand deliver it, you can put it under their door, you can mail it to them. Only one a day. That's it. Not by email, not by someone you're hoping will give you a raise or a bonus. I stopped by the coffee shop yesterday. I wasn't in a good mood. You really helped me. You put a smile on my face. Thank you. Go back to the coffee shop, hand it to the person, and walk out. One a day. 365 thank you notes a year. A year from now, you'll say, thanks for doing that, Seth. You can send me the 365th one. Thank you.
I love it. So cool. And what's the, like, why is that the practice that sticks out to you? Just curious.
Well, I needed to pick something that someone who is stuck by resistance couldn't come up with an excuse to not do. I needed to pick something that was simple and executable. I needed to pick something for a very specific audience of people. And I wanted to pick something that was 100% completely generous and cannot be hustled or gamed. Because we live in this hustling, gaming culture. There are people who do what I do, but in the opposite direction, and are constantly telling folks, oh, you got to go do this and go do this and trade this favor and ask this person and send them an email asking what's their favorite color. And then they write back, ask them a favor and blah, 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 blah. Just stop and find a way that costs you very little that lights up somebody else.
Yeah. Beautiful. So one of the things that's very recent in your life is obviously you have the book, The Song of Significance, which is out now. And one of the things you mentioned in the book that I would just love to hear you expand upon a little bit, and I wrote it down here, is you said that what we've been trained to believe about the 100,000 hours that we'll spend at work that basically just isn't helpful. And I would just love it if you could just kind of expand upon that a little bit.
Well, there's so many things that we think work is supposed to be, that it's supposed to be this compliance, scarcity-based, inhuman, mechanized system of doing what the boss said to do. That we are in a battle with the owner. They want more. We should therefore want to give them less because they're going to take advantage of us. That we have to bring a fake thing to work because it's the only way to protect ourselves. And What I am trying to explain is you're going to be at work more than you're going to be awake at home, more than you're going to be asleep for the rest of your life. And you have to make important decisions about whether you're there because you're a human or whether you're there because you're a cog in the machine. And the job you choose is going to have a lot to do with it. The deal you make with the boss is going to have a lot to do with it. And my suggestion is that we say, let's get real or let's not play. And what it means to get real is not that you're going to do less, work from home when you feel like it, ask for all the perks, get free snacks, all that stuff. Because at the core of that is the idea that you're being manipulated and that you're going to get laid off the minute things get difficult. What it means to get real is to realize that this bus is going over there and don't get on the bus if you don't want to go there. That if you joined a professional soccer team, if you did something that is ordinarily thought of as a hobby, when the people are on the field, they don't look at it as a job. They are all working together to score that goal. You deserve a job like that. You can find a job like that. You can make a job like that. But it will almost certainly not be at a famous company that picked your resume out of a pile on ZipRecruiter.
Yeah. There's, I mean, this plays through my brain a lot, and I'm very excited to hear your thoughts. Is there sort of a stigma and an ideology in today's society that a job's just a job, you're supposed to go, you get a paycheck, it's not really something you can do that you love? And I am of the opposite side of the spectrum, you know, where it's like, there's so many things you could do in this world. There's something you can actually do that you really love. Someone will actually pay you to do that thing. Like, it's out there. And I think sometimes, I mean, what I really believe is that society, school, whatever you want to call it, like, we've had so many things in our life that have created a set of beliefs for the culture and the society that no, a job's a job. You get a paycheck, you survive, you do it for, you know, 40 hours a week. And it's just like, it just like hurts me on the inside that this is the norm. And one of the things that you are, you know, known as the GOAT for, right, the greatest of all time, is spreading ideas. And so how do we start to spread the idea at a larger scale of switching from a job's not just a job, you shouldn't hate it, it's 100,000 hours, it's, you do it more than you sleep, all these things. Like, how do we switch from that and start spreading the idea of you can love what you do, it can be meaningful, it can, you know, feel like this thing where you get to be yourself, right? And you, like, how do we start to spread that idea on a bigger scale?
So for a long time, industrialists didn't care if you liked your job because they just needed you to show up. And my argument in the Song of Significance is with AI and outsourcing and computer systems and robots, if you do an average job that can be written down, we're going to find someone cheaper than you to do it. If you're a mediocre copywriter, I got a GPT that can do it better and faster and cheaper than you. And I can go down a long list of stuff like that. Now, radiologists, the folks who read x-rays, computer can read an x-ray typically better than a person can. So if you're just mediocre at it, you can't soldier on because you're gone. We don't need you anymore. Bye. So even if you wanted, because you were brainwashed to want it, a job where you didn't have to bring your full self to work, those jobs are going away. And so my argument is the only jobs that we're going to have that are left are either race to the bottom jobs where there's someone with a stopwatch at all time, counting every stroke, every click, every single thing you do, which is going to be worse than phoning it in. It's just going to be toxic. Or you're going to do work they can't get anybody else to do, because you do it in a special way, because you are hard to replace, because you are a linchpin in the system.
Yeah.
And your boss isn't going to pick you. You're going to pick yourself and show up and be that person. And that's what helps the idea spread. Because once there's one person in the coffee shop who does that, the customers notice, the boss notices, yeah. the standards change, and it becomes a different kind of place. And if they don't get the joke and they don't appreciate you, the place down the street will.
Hmm. Okay, makes sense. So if you're not doing something you love, most likely AI may replace you. And now it's, you're not doing a thing you like and you're being replaced. It's like a double negative, which does definitely not create a positive. So what can the average person, like what can our, let's say our listener who's listening to this right now, what can they do to, because I think one of the ways ideas spread as well is it's many people, right, spreading a similar message and a similar idea that catches yeah. traction. Someone else hears it, they go, oh, that's interesting. I want to talk about that to somebody else. So what can our listener right now, like what's maybe one thing they can do to start to spread this idea that we're talking about of you can actually do something that you really enjoy?
Well, I'm going to give you two. The first one, beautiful. I'm going to have to add one too because it sounds self-serving, even though it's not. I don't need to write books for a living. I don't write books for a living, but I wrote a book because books are easy to share. And yeah. when you hand a book to your boss and your coworkers, they have to respond. So that's why I bothered to make a book, so we could have a conversation about it. But yeah. the second thing is, the last paragraph I added to the book just a little while ago is, what it means to do significant work is not to change everything in one fell swoop. What it means to do significant work is the smallest generous act you can pull off for the smallest viable group of people. That's it. Hmm. If you can do one little thing for one person or one group of people, then you can do it again. If you're a school teacher and the curriculum is beating you up and they're controlling how you spend most of your day, but you can get one kid to feel a little bit better one time about fractions, you can do it again. If you can change one customer, one coworker, if you can alter the course of one meeting one time, you can do it again. And it's these acts of humanity that give us significance. And we have been so brainwashed and so intimidated, we're afraid to do them. And, you know, you've been running this podcast for a while. When you started the podcast, it wasn't obvious or easy to start a podcast, and you showed up. And then you made the second episode. And the hardest one is the 40th episode, because by then, all your illusions are gone, but you still showed up.
So true.
And plenty of people listening to this didn't. And they had 10,000 excuses. But you didn't need any money. I mean, you bought a nice microphone, but it's not expensive, right? Yeah. But some people showed up. The smallest generous act for the smallest viable audience, again and again and again.
Beautiful. Beautifully said. A few last questions I have for you. One I got from, you know, Jay Shetty, simple question, but I think a powerful answer is, for you, what do you feel like is the best piece of advice that you've ever received?
Similar to my commencement speech, which is stop looking for advice.
Okay, I love it. And then what is the worst piece of advice you've ever received?
Probably the same thing.
I love it. Okay, cool. So, Seth, it has been an honor to pick your brain, an honor to have this conversation with you. For our listener who wants to continue to hang out with you, spend time in your world, where's the best place for them to find you and be part of your world?
I am not a victim of social media. I do not let it command my day, but I have written 9,000 free blog posts at seths.blog. And if you go to seths.blog/song, you can see some videos about these ideas.
I love it. And my last question to you, which who knows what answer, maybe it'll be an answer you gave before, but it's a question we ask to all of our guests because we want to help people find direction, but we believe in doing it through action, right? You're not going to sit on your couch and la-di-da, your beautiful, magical life comes. It's, you got to take some action. So the question I would have for you is what is one thing our listener can do in the next 24 to 48 hours to start finding direction in their life?
I think what I am trying to remind people of is you cannot find the perfect direction. All you can find is a direction. And if you stop worrying about all the other directions you're going to have to leave behind and simply choose a direction, you will be better than where you are now.
I love it. And I have a sub question, actually, if it's okay. How does someone commit? Like, one of the things you've done in your work so beautifully, and I know it's in the book, I'm going to butcher the name, The Dip. What's the full title?
That's the title, six letters. You didn't butcher any of them.
Okay, beautiful. So one of the things you talk about is, like, you have to decide, right? And you make the decision before you actually start doing the work. Like, you might need to quit before you even pursue it, or you're going to stand the time. And so I love you saying, stop trying to think of what you're going to miss out on by committing to something, because it happens a lot. So when someone says that there's not going to be perfect action, there's not going to be perfect direction, but I can pick a direction and I can commit to it and stop worrying about all the other directions, how does someone commit to that?
You know, and maybe I grew up playing hockey.
I was going to say, maybe a question within that is, how do you commit when you make a decision, say, I'm going to pick this thing, I'm not going to worry about the other things, I'm just going to commit, I'm going to decide.
So I grew up playing hockey. I broke my nose, I broke my arm. I played for years, but I don't play hockey anymore. So I think getting uptight about commitment is a challenge, because whatever you commit to, you're not going to do it forever. I think what it means to commit to something is to do something, not to have a statement in writing that you're going to do something. So instead of committing, how about just doing? Simply doing, without commentary, without attachment to the outcome, just the habit of doing it, right? If you start a blog, no one's going to read it. So what's the downside? Just do it. Simply do it. Showing up and doing it. And then when you stop doing it, it's clear you're not committed. But for now, let's act like you are.
Beautiful. Well, again, thank you so much, Seth. It's been beyond an honor to have this conversation. Thank you for being here. And yeah, we appreciate you and everything you do.
Thank you, Stu.
Congratulations, my friend, on crushing it through another episode here on Finding Direction. Make sure you give yourself a pat on the back, a round of applause, because you are one of the few who is not willing to settle for less than a life that lights up your soul and that is absolutely something worth celebrating. I hope you got some wisdom from Seth. Again, this man has got golden nuggets all over every word that he says. So I hope you take some stuff from it. More importantly, I hope, as always, you start to apply it to your life. As always, thank you so much for being here, my friend. I hope you have a beautiful, wonderful, outstanding, incredible rest of your day. And if you don't feel like you want to leave, don't feel like you need to. I have another episode coming up right after this, and you are more than welcome to hang around for that. All right, my friend, I will talk to you soon. Take care.